Hey, baseball fans, it's time to swing big on your bets this season. Step up to the plate with an odds boost token from BetMGM, an official sports betting partner of Major League Baseball. No opt-in is required. Just log into your BetMGM account to receive your odds boost token. Then, place a bet on any MLB game and activate your token. If your boosted bet hits, you'll score a bigger payout, no matter the showdown. BetMGM is your betting home for baseball. Major League Baseball trademarks used with permission. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. See BetMGM.com for terms. 21 plus only. This U.S. promotion offer not available in Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. For New York, call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369. For Arizona, call 1-800-NEXT-STEP. For Massachusetts, 1-800-327-5050. For Iowa, 1-800-BETS-OFF. For Puerto Rico, 1-800-981-0023. Subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards vary and expire in 1 to 7 days. In partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
What is up, everybody? Welcome to Comic Book Club. I'm Alex.
I'm Pete.
And we are coming to you live from a couple of places on the internet. We're live on YouTube, Twitch, Instagram, not Facebook this week, because there was some sort of error. It just popped up. That's a little behind-the-scenes drama for you, Pete.
Ooh, wow.
Yeah, but you know what? Facebook, I guess they're out of luck, okay?
Yeah.
You know, they screwed the pooch on Meta, and now they screwed the pooch on our show, and that's the final straw for
Facebook. I hear you. Yeah, they screwed the pooch on me a long time ago, so I'll never go back.
Well, Pete, you were out of town last week.
That's right.
In Washington, you were lobbying, I believe, the government.
I was in Ska-mania, bro.
Oh, you were in Ska-mania. That's right. How were Mighty Mighty Bosstones? You jammed
them, they still got it. They still got it.
Oh, so cool. Wow, and you sat in with Real Big Fish as well, I believe.
Great. No, it's an actual place in Washington, the state of.
And do they play ska in Ska-mania? Or...
I didn't hear any.
Oh, okay. But you were at a business retreat.
That's right.
Yeah.
No, I was at the same place where they filmed Happy Gilmore, the fight sequence with the famous Price is Right, Bob Barker.
I was going to make another ska joke, but that's way more interesting. Wow.
Yeah.
Great times, Pete. Excited to have you back and excited that Justin isn't here this week. It's nice to
Well, he's with his mom. Patreon supporters. Shouts out.
Roxanne Tyler. We normally save that for once a month, but shout out to Roxanne Tyler for supporting the show. So thank you. Pete, does your mom support the show?
She watches sometimes.
Does she really?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. As I think I previously mentioned, we've been doing this for 18, almost 19 years.
That's
my mom still doesn't know what we do. She's like, so what are you doing again? And I'm like, Comic Book Club.
I'm sorry, your relationship hasn't gotten better with your mom.
Yeah. But you know what my relationship has gotten better with? Is fantastic guest we have tonight.
And
we have a packed roster with some amazing guests for you. Our first guest this evening, one of our favorite guys to talk to. Very excited to have him back here to talk about IDW's upcoming rebooted Godzilla line. Ladies and gentlemen, Tim Seeley.
Yes. Hey, what's up, guys? Good to see you. Nice shirt, Pete.
We are not worthy.
Yes. I got excited about Ska-mania for a second there, and then I was like, holy shit, I could see Mustard Plug, what? And then
no, it's just a town. People do business, sadly. but I'm excited to have you on here, excited to talk about Godzilla. Before we get into talking about the book, though, I did want to mention every week on the show, we have a professional chef down in Stray New Orleans. Bullies. Brett Macris, a.k.a. Stray Bullies. He cooks at a restaurant called Shift that is awesome. If you're ever down in New Orleans, go there. It's fantastic. But he always either curates or creates a cocktail for us. And this week, he created a Godzilla cocktail.
Oh, yeah.
There you go. It is Godzilla, a little touchy-feely.
Oh, man.
Yeah,
I'm gonna screen cap that right there. That's I'm taking that one for myself.
Please do. Please do.
So yes, this riffing for new listeners off a touchy feely tip.
I don't think we have new listeners, but I appreciate what
not at said. This point.
No,
but this has rum, blue curacao, simple syrup, lime juice, mint leaves, plus some for garnish that provides the green a la Godzilla, lime wedge, soda water, or club soda. And it's all tribute to both you and Godzilla.
Glorious. I'm going to make
what a combo.
Yeah, I'm going to make one of those in the basement bar.
And this is also paying tribute to the new, tell me if I'm getting this right, Kaisei era? Is that how you pronounce it?
Yeah, it's a bullshit word I made up.
Oh, the did Kaisei. You make it up? Okay, you're to blame for this. Okay.
Yes, I did.
Well, so this is to give the lay the groundwork for this. There is a bunch of titles that IDW has been doing for a while in Godzilla and different continuities. This is a new, rebooted, cohesive continuity. Got a little bit of a tease on Free Comic Book Day with a special. And then it's spinning off into three titles that are very different and seem to take place in almost different time periods. Got the main Godzilla title, which is by you, art by, I'm also probably getting this wrong, Nicola Cismeja?
Sure.
Great great artist,
doing our
is
best
what I like to call him. And then there's two other titles as well, one Spaceship Godzilla and Godzilla Enter the Dead Zone. Did I get that correct?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, and they're not timelines, they're different genres almost. It really they're sort of, they take place concurrently, but they're each a kind of different direction for a Godzilla title.
Yeah. And so I won't spoil too much, but we did get a chance to read yours, and it is a wildly different take. I think a great take, but is it fair to say that it's almost like inserting a sort of superhero genre into Godzilla in a way?
Yeah.
Or you're nodding your head-ish.
Yeah, I mean, well, it's not much of an insertion because G-Force has been part of Godzilla for so long, but I think our take on it was sort of more, you know, playing with the G-Force idea, but having them be very intrinsically American, I guess, because in the past, G-Force is either, you know, Japanese or it's a UN force. And so we were going with this idea that, you know, that for a long time, Godzilla has been attacking the world. And this G-Force is sort of an American team returning to the world stage after being exiled out of interacting with the rest of the world for being assholes. And so they've got this very distinct sort of approach. And so it has very superhero aspects because that's so American, but, but yeah, it's really playing up sort of, it's definitely, I guess the take Jake and I talked about was sort of like, well, what if the G-Force was kind of like the Ultimates or like the Authority or, you know, that kind of group, because we really wanted to do something which was also, you know, less about fighting Godzilla with tanks and nukes and airplanes and stuff, and really go be like, let's just have some dudes, some people that have to get together and whoop on kaiju.
Well, and to take it back a little bit, it almost seems like G.I. Joe in a way, like, not to call out another energy-based universe, but you do have this American team, this very rah-rah team going up against Godzilla at the same time. Was that any bit of the inspiration as well?
Yeah, I mean, for sure. Yeah, yeah. And it's definitely, you know, I mean, a little bit of it was sort of traditionally the way that a Godzilla story is told, I think, is a little bit, you know, it's kind of nationalistic in Japan way. And I kind of want to play with what we want to mess with was like, what are the politics of America versus Japan? And how do we deal with environmental problems or big problems? And, you know, Japan has this sort of history to some degree of being very, you know, inclusive. And it's all about each individual, you know, every individual is part of the group and they try to solve problems. Whereas America is like, let's kill it for ourselves, you know. And so we want to put that back into it as well.
And go ahead, Pete.
I just wanted to ask a little bit of, like, where did your fandom for Godzilla start? Like, when did it kind of first open your eyes or get into your life?
I mean, so I'm, you know, I'm 48 now, so I'm Gen Xer. I was 7 when Godzilla 1984 came out. That was a big deal at the time. It was like a, you know, like a serious Godzilla movie in 1984. And it was a reboot, right? It was like going back and sort of starting a new era. And that ended up being the Heisei era, which is kind of the most sort of probably pervasive among most people now, I think, Godzilla era. So, so when we were kids, we were just, it was just, you know, VHSs that my dad could pick up and drop us in front of the TV and watch. So that's how I saw, you know, a lot of the Godzilla movies at the same time as like Ultraman and stuff like that. And then when I was in my 20s, early 20s, I lived next to a video store and I had no money. I was out of college and I was broke. And they had free rentals of kids' movies and they had all the Godzillas on there. So, so like I would just go home after my day job. My girlfriend worked at a call center at night, so I would just like plop on a Godzilla movie. So I was also completely immersed in that era, which is the Millennium era as well.
Oh, cool. Well, what do you think? I mean, to riff off of that a little bit, what do you think is so malleable about Godzilla? Because even looking at the comic book world alone this year, there are so many different takes. Yeah. On Godzilla, what is it about this property that makes it open to so many different takes, not to repeat the same word?
Yeah, I mean, I guess if we had known like that there was going to be a bunch of Marvel books with Godzilla, we might have done something slightly different, which we didn't know. I didn't know, but...
it's a Godzilla boom right now.
It's a Godzilla boom. Well,
I mean, not to interrupt you, but I'd say just for anybody who doesn't know, not to lay it out, but like you have this IDW Kaisei universe, you've got Marvel's versus books, DC is doing their Justice League versus Godzilla versus Kong, which is in Legendary's Monsterverse. And then there's, I feel like at least one more that I'm forgetting, like plus movie stuff is going on.
Yeah,
at the same
yeah,
time.
Yeah.
But legit, like the Marvel stuff has come out. The first Justice League thing has come out. Reading ahead on these books as well. They're all so different. Like I understand yeah. being a little, hey, sorry, this is overlapping. It's not overlapping. I feel like they're very yeah. different takes.
Well, and I think Godzilla is worked so well because, you know, over the course of trying to reinvent this character so many times, and Toho has done it, and Toho has licensed it to other people to do it, you know, and the key with Godzilla, I think, is that Godzilla is a force of nature, not necessarily a character, and specifically, and the world that exists around Godzilla is affected by it. So you can tell a million different stories, you know, because... this is a story about people dealing with something bigger than themselves that they can barely conceive of, who happens to look awesome and then occasionally destroy a city and occasionally whoop on another monster that we can barely conceive of. So it's just this sort of really flexible framework. So you can do, and you know, going back to the Marvel Godzilla comics, which had Godzilla fighting S.H.I.E.L.D. and you know, stuff like that, to the films, which have had, you know, all kinds of different takes, some more serious, some comedic, some kids movies, to, you know, which I think the IDW stuff did really well was that they could do all kinds of genres. So you had, you know, the first one, which was a crime story that John Layman did. You had, you know, stories that were more like sort of military kind of thing. They just did a heist story with Godzilla. Mm-hmm. And as I tried to prove with my Godzilla versus Chicago stories that I want to do a romantic comedy with Godzilla. So, nice. So you know, Godzilla is super flexible. The world of which Godzilla operates in is super flexible. And our take on it was, well, what if every Godzilla story is basically true? And we tell a story in this particular case, you know, with the people tasked with dealing with that in America. And then the other ones are people dealing with very different ramifications of Godzilla in different genres, essentially.
Yeah. Well, you're starting to touch on this, but what is involved in building out a new Godzilla universe then? Like, where did the Kaisei energy thing come from? What is the connection there? What's the coordination like?
I mean, it was something we talked about because we wanted to do... Godzilla is so intrinsically tied with, obviously, you know, the original 1954 movie and, you know, atomic testing, which is really where that... And it's such a... It's a very much inherently a sort of Cold War idea, right? A post-World War II idea. And something we were kind of kicking around was if there was a way to take Godzilla's powers and make them something that can connect a whole bunch of different titles. And so the Kaisei, which is loosely and bullshitly translated, which is Kaiju, and that is essentially Strange Beast, and Sei, which is energy. So Strange Beast energy essentially is what it is. And so the idea is that, you know, there was some other energy source. We want to make it a bit of a mystery. Something else was used to create Godzilla, not nuclear energy. And so this sets off this sort of worldwide chase for that source, and it kind of goes through these other titles. And our Godzilla is really playing off something that exists already, but Godzilla is kind of the vengeance of the planet. Like, the there's a reason the energy is green, and there's a reason for all this stuff is that, you know, the metaphor of Godzilla from the original films is taken like, no, that's it. Like, Godzilla is an engine of you know, the erasing the folly of man, to quote the Blue Oyster Cult song, you know? So like that's sort of, and that also can fuel other kaiju. And in our case, it can also mutate people. So our lead character in this is a guy named Jason, who happens to be a G mutant, which are people who've been exposed to the same Kaisei energy. And so he's a kid with the fire of Godzilla, essentially.
Cool. And not that you're necessarily writing the other books, but like we mentioned, we do have this Enter the Dead Zone, which I think is like touched on a little bit in the first issue here. And then you have the spaceship Godzilla as well. So how do these connect? Are they all, like you said, they're all different genres. They definitely have all very different unique art styles at the same time. But what's the sort of interweaving like on these?
They're sort of all based around an event, which I don't want to give away too much on it, but essentially, yeah, there's an event that happened in the past that very clearly kind of connects, especially Dead Zone and main Godzilla book. But that also plays into Starship Godzilla. And it's fluid in that it doesn't have to be like, you know, it's a launch point from which all the titles have to start with, but it provides us this sort of background universe. And that's why you can see things referenced. You'll see it more as we kind of expand the map. There's a reason our story kind of takes place almost entirely in the coastal areas, like from San Diego to Florida up to New York, and you don't see anything sort of in the middle of the country. So we play with, you know, the big idea that Godzilla's appearance on Earth, you know, some 80 years ago, totally impacted history. Like, this is not our world. This is a world of which, you know, Godzilla shows up in 54 and nothing was the same ever again, right? Like, it would be impossible to sort of go forward in history knowing that there's also this giant monster that can at any time destroy everything. It just sort of philosophically how it changes nations and how they are different from each other. So that's kind of how we play it, I think, to give you something that you haven't really seen before.
Cool. And what is it like working with Nicola Cismeja, whose name, again, I'm probably mangling?
It's awesome. Nicola comes from like that very like manga kind of art style. And that's something we wanted to bring into this kind of, because I think, you know, it's Japanese and it's been played. We've seen lots of sort of Japanese versions of it. We've seen a lot of American comics versions of it. So this one is a little bit of a hybrid. So Nicola does awesome, big action, kind of One Punch Man kind of stuff. And he's also a fan of that kind of stuff, which, you know, I don't care about that much, being honest. But, you know, knowing that I can sort of give him that reference and he'll get it and he'll bring that energy that he loves about manga superhero stuff and kaiju stuff to this.
Yeah. Awesome. I did want to ask you about one other thing, or mention one other thing. I know we were talking about it a little bit before we went on, but I just wanted to give you a chance to plug, if you like. Revival is finally coming out June 12th on Sci-Fi, adaptation of your book. I know you've done movie stuff before, but is this the first adaptation of your work that's made it to screen?
Yes.
Oh my gosh.
Okay. It took me 25 years. Oh, yes. But yes, it is the first.
You all right, man?
Yeah, man, I'm just so tired. It took so long. But yeah, it's I was talking with Alex a little bit before. I know you got to see it. I watched the first couple episodes on Saturday with the producer.
Oh, wow.
You know, finished, ready to go with music, all the stuff that it was missing when I was seeing early cuts. So feels good. Feels good.
Well, congratulations.
Awesome. Yeah, and that's coming out, as I said, June 12th on Sci-Fi. Anything else Can't before wait. We let you go? Anything else you want to plug?
Oh, man.
To check out?
I know. I mean, I'm always. Yeah, I feel like I'm always doing shit. I don't know. It's weird. It's like I was, because I'll, you know, feel like, oh, man, I'm always working on stuff. And then when people are like, hey, what are you working on? I'm like,
well, you got, I wasn't going to spend too much time bringing up, but you got the Vigilante Eagly double feature, which we talked to you.
Yes, there we go.
Back at New York Comic Con. That's super fun.
Yeah.
There was, not to get too much into this, but I remember right after the announcement, you're like, yep, it's sort of between season one and season two. And then DC, yeah. I remember, not to call them out, but there was this like, just to be clear, this is a different continuity than the show, just so everybody knows. So
is that what they said? They said it was a different.
They were like, it is a Black Label story like other Black Label stories. So it's okay. Inspired by.
Yeah, I think it was weird because if I'm just trying to guess like how what all shook out there is like if we had announced it right at that spot that like, hey, it's you know, connected to the TV show, it would have been the first official like new DC Cinematic Universe thing. Which is a lot for a comedy comic with two stories, five issues to bear, I think. And so, you know, whatever we thought it was, they were like, oh, God, you know, that's save that for when Superman gets announced. And, you know, so I think it all shook out fine. I mean, I think it's very clearly set in the TV universe, and that's what I was working on when I was working from scripts and stuff. So, great. I hope everybody enjoyed it either way. If it's not official, great. If it is, great. Same whatever jokes were going to happen either way. So.
Well, we are definitely really enjoying it, and I'm trying to think if there's anything else you're doing that I can plug for you, but I'm blanking at the moment.
Oh, yeah, there we go. And the Rogue Savage Land, fifth issue comes out in 2 weeks, too, then. Yes. So I got that.
That's great as well. Tim, thank you so much for coming on. Thank you
for chatting. Thank you for all your great work. We really appreciate it.
Thanks, guys. Always a pleasure to see you.
Great
to see you. Tell Justin to fuck himself.
Yeah! This guy's a legend.
Good night, Tim. All right. There we go. Lovely. Just to plug that stuff again. Godzilla. That's simply the name of the book from IDW. You can pre-order that, I believe, on June 9th from your comic book store. It's going to be on sale on July 23rd, right before San Diego Comic-Con. And that is the kickoff of the new Godzilla Kaisei universe. And it's very cool. Also, as I mentioned, Revival is coming out June 12th on Sci-Fi. First episode there stars, I always get her name wrong, but Melody Scrofano. From Winona Earp. Anyway, she's great. Everybody loves her. So there you go. Awesome. We got a bunch more guests, though. So why don't we get into our next one here? He is the creator behind Naked City, a graphic novel, which is out now from Dark Horse. Ladies and gentlemen, Eric Drucker. Eric,
welcome. How are you?
Hey, thank you for having me. Thank you for allowing me into your clubhouse.
No worries. Gosh,
totally. I love this book. This has been out since October, I think. So it's been out for a little while.
Something like that, It's been a few months.
But this is, and I'm sort of talking the PR language here, but this is the concluding part of your New York trilogy. I think it very much stands alone for anybody, you know, obviously check out the previous two books. But this one, you can jump right into it. And it's this really beautiful intersecting story of different artists living in New York. I mean, I think I can tell from briefly talking to you partially what this is inspired by. But talk a little bit about like, and maybe this is too big of a topic, but talk a little bit about your relationship with New York as an artist.
My relationship with New York. Well, it's a familial relationship. I came out of it. Born and raised on Manhattan Island.
All right.
Right. And lived on the East Side there. Really grew up around the Lower East Side, the Tompkins Square District, they call it now. So it definitely marked on my work. Even when I go away, I've escaped. I'm set up in Berkeley, California these days. But it doesn't matter. All of the artwork still takes place in New York City. Nice. You know, I'm free to dream. I have dreams that I'm all over the place, on different planets, lost at sea, under the earth. And yet it's always like the New York City subway. It's never the San Francisco BART train or the Tokyo subway. If it's a subway underground, it's always the IRT train. Mm. So there's that relationship with the city. And I'm also third generation New Yorker. My mother's from the Bronx. Nice. You know, both of her parents were born and raised in New York City. So it's definitely in the blood, as it were. And it's really unconscious. I don't really have to make much of an effort to tell stories or try to explain or use the city as any type of metaphor. It is sort of an organic filter that kind of all of my work seems to pass through, whether I like it or not. You know, right? for better or worse. And I can move to some rural area the rest of my life, but I'm still a city kid, whether I like it or not. And most of the artwork takes place in the city. And this story, Naked City, obviously, it's not only takes place in New York City, but it's an expose of the city. New York is almost the archetypal city. It could be London, Paris, could be any big city. It's really New York is the quintessential city, isn't it? This is really kind of behind the scenes, ripping the mask off the city. So not only do we see the different characters, like Isabel, we see on the front cover here with her guitar, but she's having a really rough time in the first chapter or two, making a living, making ends meet, playing her music. We see her playing music on the street, down on the subway platforms, places like this, just busking around town. And she's just barely able to make ends meet. But that's when she has to get a job as an artist model. She finds that she could be working and getting paid in cash, posing for an artist. And so we get to see the protagonist without her clothes on. But then by the second chapter, we get to see the painter himself without his clothes on. And by the third chapter, we realize that all of the characters in the story are we see them in different states of not only nakedness, but just emotional vulnerability is really what it's about. It's not really about literal nakedness.
Mm-hmm. Well, sorry to interrupt. I just wanted to mention, I thought it was very interesting how you depicted nudity in this book because it was abstracted. You know, you have these forms that almost look like sculpture. Like, to get very specific about it, they do not have nipples. You know, there are genitals occasionally, but they're relatively just sort of, they're sketches of that more than anything. How much of that is your art style and how much of that was purposeful for the themes you're talking about?
That was intentional to leave it somewhat abstract. I mean, we're in this very weird moment right now, cultural moment where everyone, whether they're left wing or right wing, is in a big rush to not only censor your ass, but to cancel you permanently for like a drop of a hat, you know? So that's one reason why I left things semi-abstract. And I also thought artistically it was maybe a little bit more, it was leaving more to the imagination. It just felt aesthetically, it seemed called for. And even as a cartoonist, so much of the art of cartooning, as you well know, it's about what we leave out, the details that we leave out. Is it necessary? Not necessary. Okay, then leave it out. Only leave out those lines that are like serving the story and serving the narrative. Otherwise, you could totally leave them out. It's more economical that way. Leave out as many details as possible.
Well, to that end, I mean, to keep going on sort of this thought train, while I was reading the book, it felt like, you know, there's some rough things that happen to the characters here. And just to mention, to like expand for the plot for anybody who's read it, you do follow this guitarist. It goes into the artist. You start to weave in other characters, go back and forth, follow the different characters down different paths until they come crashing back together or crashing apart. But the entire time, both through your art style and the way you're telling it, it does feel like almost this dream of the city in a certain way. And certainly there are characters dreaming in there, but as much as I wanted to put a time period on when I was reading, like, oh, this is the '80s. No, wait, this is the '90s. I think it's all of that and none of that. Right.
That's right. It's sort of timeless. I mean, there are a lot of things that are anchoring it to right now, that is the 21st century. Mm-hmm. I have certain giveaways, like, well, when there's a knock on the door and it's the ICE police, mm-hmm. and they come mm-hmm. and grab her, put handcuffs on her mother and take her mother away. She never sees her mother again. That's definitely 21st century America. I mean, that's right what we're living through right now.
Yeah.
And then again, it's not really the first time we've been in this spot, in this culture. People have been deported right about this time a century ago. Emma Goldman was being deported from East 13th Street and 3rd Avenue there, that block where the Scorsese film Taxi Driver on. That block on 13th Street and 3rd Avenue, that a lot, there was an earlier generation of immigrants who got sent back to where they came from then. So it's some of the themes that I'm playing with in the story, Naked City, are about these recurring themes through American history, whether it's the Cold War, anti-communist hysteria in the 1950s and McCarthyism, or just the hysteria that we went through right around the millennia, the anti-terrorism hysteria, or what we're going through now. What would we call it? I guess it's take your pick. There are many things going on now, but there's the hysteria about, that you're some kind of illegal alien, right? Mm-hmm. You're not legal. You don't have you're not documented. Well, yes, I am. Well, then let's see your documents. Let's see your papers. Are your papers in order? You know, what does that sound like? Mm-hmm. So I'm dealing with some of these recurring themes. And to answer an earlier question, yes, it is very dreamlike. A lot of my work is inspired by dreams. Just the logic of dreams, the way things aren't necessarily cause and effect. And the way things recur, sometimes things happen over and over again, but they play out a little bit differently each time. So I left a lot of things loose for that. I felt like it would be more unpredictable that way and more suspenseful storytelling that way. And I also thought it would be a way of just creating an amalgam between fiction, you know, high entertainment, having a certain amount of comedy thrown in, mm-hmm. but then also having some tragedy mixed in. And as we know, the best comedy always has some tragedy blended right into it. And just also a mix of social realism, a good dose of reality thrown in. Why not? Again, some of the best comedy has a good dose of reality mixed right in there with it. It doesn't have to be total fantasy world. I've always been inspired by the work of Charles Chaplin.
Mm-hmm. Right? Nice.
Not just his shorts, but the feature films that he wrote and directed and starred in. He usually had a pretty good balance of the comedy and the tragedy and the imaginative and then the social reality. The social criticism, whether it was The Great Dictator, where he's literally talking about the rise of Adolf Hitler going on in the background in the 1930s, when the rest of U.S. culture wasn't really quite taking it seriously. and certainly wasn't making comedy films out of it. But also the works of Buster Keaton and a lot of that silent comedy, because it had so much, there was so much physical humor in it. And because it was so black and white, again, there was something very abstract about it. It was almost as if they were deciding how much information can we leave out? What can we leave out and only include those elements in the story that we really want to draw attention to? So those are a couple of influences.
Yeah. I mean, another, not to keep throwing themes out at you, but this certainly occurred to me while you were just talking, is there's also an ongoing theme or an ongoing plot point, actually, of the intersection between art and commerce, because each of these characters are presented with choices throughout the book of, well, they want to make their art, they love their art, but also they got to live, they got to eat, they got to have an apartment, maybe they want fame. Is that what they're interested in? Do they want the money? As somebody who has had their brushings with Hollywood, you've worked on movies, you have one in, I don't know what stage of development. I imagine that's something that's very top of mind for you when you're approaching a piece like this.
Yes. Oh, definitely. For all artists living in, especially living in the U.S., economics looms large, right? I mean, you don't have to be an artist. You could be a barista, you know, you could be a construction worker, whatever your gig is, you're not just thinking about economics, but you're concerned. You have a lot of anxiety about commerce. Right. So that's just the economic reality. Perhaps it's always been an economic reality. With the arts, it's extra poignant, especially in recent years where there have been so many cutbacks. I mean, it's really down to the bone now, where I don't think it's ever been quite this difficult to make a living being an artist in the U.S. I mean, I could be wrong, but I don't know of any time when it was quite this uphill, where it's like damn near impossible now. Man, so many of my friends are musicians and writers and artists, but it seems like only a small minority of them are actually able to make a living at it. And I don't know if that wasn't the case 20 or 30 years ago, when rent was more affordable and things like that. And the fact is, as we all know, that the price of everything has just gone up, especially rent and food and all of the raw materials, art supplies, things like that. And yet we're not getting paid anymore. I'm still getting paid the same rates that I was getting paid 20 or 30 years ago. And yet somehow the landlord is able to convince everyone that due to the increased expenses on our part, we're going to have to pass these expenses along to you, the customer. People in the creative field, I think, are really feeling it acutely right now. I mean, so many of my friends are making a living as school teachers or just teaching music. Maybe they can't make a living playing guitar, but they could make a living teaching guitar, which is great, except it leaves that much less. There's less time in the day for them to have, you know, to be playing their own instrument. So those are some of the equations and existential decisions that all of the characters in this story, Naked City, have to make, whether it's Isabel, the singer-songwriter, who's the main protagonist, or the painter you're trying to make a living in the gallery scene in New York, or Alex, who's a dancer, an amazing dancer, but she's having a hell of a time getting anyone to pay her to be an avant-garde dancer. Or anyone, even the guy who's just cleaning the windows, the squeegee man. I mean, he's actually doing something that people need, and he's having an impossible time making a living at it. And he certainly didn't have any protection, you know, when he had his accident. He wasn't able to get anyone to help him with his rent or help him buy food during the months that he was recuperating. So that's, I guess that's the recurring theme, is people across the spectrum, but I'm really focusing in on the creative people in the creative arts, how they're surviving now in the 21st century. And that's the question that they're all asking. And it's not a rhetorical question. We're asking, is it possible to make a living as a, and support oneself as an artist in the 21st century? It's really an open question.
Well, another thing that the characters are asking throughout the book is, who is this for? You know, we get Isabel at a certain point hits a level of fame, and the way that you draw the crowds are just these faceless mobs. She's wondering aloud, who are these people? Who is listening to his music? I don't understand this. And the painter repeatedly asks the gallery owner, wait, who is interested in these paintings? Who is buying them? And the gallery owner is like, don't worry about it. It's just money. Don't worry about it. When you're creating something like Naked City, when you're at the drawing board, how are you thinking about that in terms of the relationship with your audience? Or is that something that you're trying to put out of your mind?
Yeah, that's a really good question. Because it's so mysterious, isn't it? I mean, I know from over the years, I know who certain people who follow my work or, you know, have bought my work, bought my books in the past. I know what some of my audience, you know, I know who some of these people are, but it's just really a small percentage, right? I mean, the masses of people, the thousands or tens of thousands who see my work or are buying my work, I don't know who the hell they are. I'm curious who they are, but there's not really any way of me knowing them, or would I even have time to get to know them all? So that, I think that's where the leap of faith takes place for artists, especially visual artists. So maybe it's a little different for my musician friends or people on stage where they have an audience and they see the people in the room sitting there enjoying or, you know, clapping or dancing along with them to the art that they're creating. But when you're just alone in a room and you're a visual artist or a writer, I guess the same thing could be said for a writer. It's such a solitary gig out of necessity, right? You almost have to be all alone in order to do the thing in the first place. And it's really a paradox in a way that I didn't realize this till I was in my early 30s that, whoa, wait a minute. This is a contradiction in terms. In order for me to be communicating and relating to the masses of people, to thousands of people all at once, requires me locking myself all alone in a chamber for 10 hours a day. Mm-hmm. Now, how does that work, you know, so that then when COVID hit and the pandemic lockdown started 4 or 5 years ago, so many of us cartoonists and writers, we didn't really feel it so dramatically because we were already socially distancing. We were already isolating. It was all in a day's work for us. We almost didn't notice anything, that anything was wrong, until we stepped out or tried to go to the grocery store, right? We noticed, hey, wait a minute, there's something is off. What's going on? Where are people wearing these masks? Where do I get one of those masks? Oh, they're all sold out? Well, then who's supplying them? And then we had to learn about it that way. But just trying to answer your question again, and this is very much one of the themes in the story, is who is the audience and how alienated are we really from the audience? I suppose you could say this for any workers, how we're all alienated from our labor in different degrees. But for an artist, I think that ultimately, it's a leap of faith. You just have to say, well, you know what? Maybe I'll never know. And maybe that's just going to have to be okay. Maybe I'm just doing this for my friends or a small circle of friends or people who I would like to be friends with someday. Or maybe I'm just even just doing it for myself. Maybe I'm just trying to tell a story here, that story that I always wished someone else would have written by now. And I've heard that that's often the way novelists work. A lot of my writer friends say, yeah, that's actually not a bad way to proceed. Write something as if it's the story that you wish that you could read, but that hadn't been written yet, rather than the alternative, which would be trying to anticipate, well, what is it that the public is really going to like? What's likely to be a real hit now? And to try to second guess, you know, where is the zeitgeist mm-hmm. going? What's going to be a big box office hit? I mean, there are some artists or Hollywood writers who are successful at working that way. But I think most artists, even when we've attempted that, you know, that path, it usually doesn't pan out that well. It doesn't pan out that way. And it's a little, there's so many unpredictable elements that at the end of the day, it almost makes more sense to just tell a story or to play a melody or draw a picture in the style that you would like to see a picture drawn in. And then just go with that. Just go with your gut, your intuition, and you know what makes you, what gives you the most joy in drawing it, and to just let the rest of it slide, because you can't really control it that well anyway. Just and maybe that's just a good approach to any kind of creative activity.
Just to start to wrap up and wrap it back to the beginning, now that you have done 3 books on this topic, on the topic of New York, do you feel like you've said what you need to say about the city, or is there more there?
Well, there's certainly a lot more. I feel like I've said what I needed to say on certain themes, like what was it like being a young person growing up mm-hmm. in the city? I've told that story a few times, but I haven't told the story yet about what's it like to grow old in the city. I haven't done that one yet, so maybe that one is still coming. I'm working on a book now that's it's only partially in comics. It's also partly in paintings, and part of it is simply in writing. But it's about growing up in New York City, so it's almost a visual memoir.
Oh, cool.
If that answers the question. In other words, no, I'm not finished. I'm still
I think that's the answer.
I'm just getting started, you know.
Great.
The glad irony is that you'd think that I would have gotten it out of my system by now, but it seems that the city, you know, it's the gift that keeps on giving, mm-hmm. especially a city like Manhattan, which is so dense, and there's so many languages being spoken, and so much is being thrown at you that you could never really absorb it at the time. You could only kind of absorb it gradually, you know, after the fact. You could try to make sense of it. And that's part of, I think, what artwork is you're trying to make sense of it and put what you experienced into some kind of natural, cohesive structure that trying to have it make sense. Mm-hmm. to you or presented in a way that maybe you've learned, you know, what have you learned mm-hmm. from decades of living in the city? Well, maybe you want to include that in the story.
Well, it definitely comes through in this book. Eric, this is a fantastic graphic novel.
Yeah,
thank you so much for taking the time.
Hey,
to
you're
chat
quite welcome. Thank you.
Yeah.
For having me. It was a pleasure talking with you guys.
You too.
Thank you.
All right. Have a good night, Eric.
Okay. Later.
All right. There we go. The book is once again called Naked City, a graphic novel. It is out now from Dark Horse Comics, and it's really phenomenal. And like Pete said, it is a beautiful novel. So definitely check it out.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
In Indiana, summer means more than sunshine. It's hiking miles and miles of trails to magnificent views and cruising through caves on underground river rides. It's spending the night in a floating cabin and scuba diving into your next big adventure. It's riding a horse and buggy through historic towns and camping with elephants at a wildlife park. It's anything but ordinary. Plan your trip at inindiana.com/summer.
And we have one more, or rather two more guests for you this evening. They are two of the guys behind Lake Yellowwood Slaughter, which is on Kickstarter right now. Ladies and gentlemen, Sebastian Gerter and Alejandro Arbona.
Hey, welcome.
Welcome. Thank you so much for your patience. Excited to have you guys on. Excited to talk about this project. I'm excited to talk about this project. Yes, we're gonna work this out. So this is on Kickstarter now. I love this book. Sebastian, you're in charge. Just to give context for everybody, Sebastian is in charge of Goats Flying Press, which has made a big splash already with just a couple of books. This one is by Alejandro with art by Gavin Grigiri. We talked to him about it down in New Orleans when we did a show there. Yeah. Expressed how excited we were about this book. This is, not to ruin the conceit of it too much for anybody, but I think you're pretty open about this. It is a comic book adaptation of a movie, an 80s slasher movie that never existed, is essentially the idea there. I know you talk about this on the Kickstarter. Could you talk us through a little bit of the inspiration there? I know there was one movie in particular, but were there any movies in particular?
Well, yeah, the inspiration basically comes from, having spent all our lives watching slasher movies. And for me, in the last few years, I've become very into giallo movies, which are Italian murder mysteries, which predate slashers and kind of inspired slashers. And to your question, the inspiration here was about the fictional adaptation of a 1983 slasher movie that never existed. But on a more meta level, it's a slasher movie that was made by an Italian director of giallo movies. You know, by 1983, the giallo trend in Italy was winding down, right when slasher were becoming extremely successful. So this is the story of a summer camp killer that comes from an imaginary movie that was made by a director who came from Italy and just immediately veered away from the slasher tropes and made the movie he was used to in the Italian cinema market.
So what do you need to start then with this, something like this? Do you need to sketch out the movie? Did you start with the graphic novel? How did this actually begin craft-wise?
I should say, I think I do myself a disservice by front-loading all of that stuff about the behinds, because none of that is really on the page of the book at all. That's all headcanon. The book is the story of, you've got a summer camp in 1983. It's drop-off day. There's obviously going to be a killer in the woods. It trades on this familiar setup of, like, we all know what's coming. There's a killer waiting to just sharpening his knife. And then the parents of the kids are very excited that they're going to have their first child-free summer in 10 years. And they've got lakeside vacation mansions. They're going to drink and they're going to party and they're going to sleep around. And then the killer goes after them instead. Mm. So that's basically the setup to the premise of what ends up happening.
One of the things that I love about this is just the mere idea of a graphic novel adaptation of a movie, which is something that I think, like, I mean, it still happens, mind you, but a lot less than when I was a kid. And I feel like we were talking about this in our Discord the other day, but I remember, and this is definitely going to date myself, but I remember obsessively reading Marvel's adaptation of Krull when I was a kid. I loved it. I read it a million times. Then I saw Krull and I was like, well, this isn't as good. It wasn't. I don't know. I love the comic book adaptation, but like, that was the sort of thing I read all the time. I picked up all of those comic book adaptations of those movies. was that in your head when you were tackling this, and what makes a comic book adaptation of a movie different than, say, just making a, you know, a slasher graphic novel? Is there a separation there?
Yeah, I mean, I have very strong feelings about this separation in between comics and movies as media. I don't think you should make comics to try to make movies. Your comic book should not be like a movie on the page. Comics are their own thing. And ironically, when I had this idea, I specifically had the idea that it should be a slasher movie, because it plays with the tropes of a slasher movie. And I was like, but it's a comic. Like, am I going to make it? Am I going to say it's a slasher comic or whatever? And for some reason, the idea of a official comic book adaptation was hot on the heels of the initial idea. Partly because, like you were saying, Alan, when I was a kid, I had all of these comic book adaptations of movies that would be R-rated movies that would be extremely gory. Like there was the Darkman adaptation or the RoboCop, the Marvel Comics RoboCop adaptation. Movies that would be super brutal, super gruesome, but then the comic book would be approved by the Comics Code Authority, suitable for all ages. So you get these extreme levels of violence, but it would be kind of sanitized for 12-year-old readers, or you would have swearing that would just be like wingdings, and you would have purple, like, narration captions that would have all of this kind of purple florid prose. And right away, I thought, oh, it would be so fun to do all of those things. So this comic is basically like a slasher movie, a giallo movie, but it has every one of the elements. Just the violence is pretty graphic, but it's sort of presented in a way that's like comic book appropriate, you know, it's teen reader appropriate, maybe. It certainly has narration captions that are very florid. We have all of it. The only thing we don't have is the actual Comics Code Authority approving it, because they don't exist anymore. I wouldn't have told them.
I love hearing all of that, and I wouldn't expect any less. I mean, both of you have a deep, deep history in comics and a clear love of comics. I know that very clearly. And as soon as I heard about this project, this isn't even leading up to a question. This is just something that occurred to me and why I knew this was going to be on the right track, like you were saying, is normally when we'd have something like this come on the show, it would clearly be a movie script that they wrote and their agent told them, you're never going to get that made. You should make it into a comic to do proof of concept. So I love the fact that you are 100% clearly coming at this as a comic first, which is great. Yeah. So glad to hear it. Sebastian, just to turn it over to you, this is part of Goats Flying Press. I mean, for those who don't know the imprint yet, do you want to talk about just sort of like the MO, your mission statement behind Goats Flying Press, and why Lake Yellowwood Slaughter was the right project to have come out here?
Yeah, absolutely. So Goats Flying Press is a town independent publisher, born right here in Brooklyn. At the start, this is only 2 years ago, I launched it in 2023. I had one book that I wanted to do, which is the first book that we kickstarted, which is The Dead and the Damned, which is a dark fantasy, a horror apocalypse comic written by myself with art by the wonderful Kelly Williams. That was just, it was just too much. The comic that we had been pitching around, and as an editor and writer, more as an editor, I understood why I was having trouble getting that book across the finish line for a variety of publishers. It was pretty big. It was pretty bleak, and it didn't give an editor a lot to work with, because it was very much like, would you like this? It's like if I come into your house and like, I put a giant slab of black ice with like corpse parts sticking out of it, still frozen, and be like, here you go. Do you like it? And you're like, let me work with it. So I got a bunch of notes back on it. And it would have taken about this much work for me to unpack the notes and make changes to the script and kind of retool the entire pitch to be more, make it more tasteful for a publisher. Or could do, my estimate, about the same amount of work to found a publisher, kickstart it, print it myself, market it myself, do everything myself. Oh, wow. And that was in my life where I felt like, I just want to kind of do this. I decided to found a publishing entity because I figured, well, if I like it and I kind of want people to maybe get used to the idea of backing a publisher on Kickstarter as opposed to, I mean, I didn't come up with the idea. There's plenty of them. Mm-hmm. I like that idea. And then the first Kickstarter went well. I did another one, and that one went well. And then a couple of books landed in my lap because, well, Alejandro and I had been talking, and we're good friends. We actually met on this show in 2008.
Oh, really?
Yep,
wow. That was my first
week. Yes. That was my first week at Marvel, and I was invited out because the assistant editors were on your show for Assistant Editor Month.
Oh, that's right.
I remember doing that. I don't remember us meeting there.
I have a vivid memory of that's like you were wearing like the jumpsuit, and I didn't know everyone yet. Like I literally just started that week, and I kind of went out for the first time, you know, in New York, and I'm, you know, still very fresh. So nice. There's a nice circle here. Awesome. Anyway, back to the Flying Press. Alejandro and I and worked together for a long time. For the last couple of years, we've all had the fortune to be neighbors, which is really nice. So we're here in Brooklyn, and we meet up and we talk a lot of comics and grab beers. And he told me about like Yellow. It's so cool. Like it's so much of what he loves, and just like all the layers that he's discussed. Where it's like, yes, it's a slasher, but it's also a jolly. It's also based on a movie that never existed, and just the kind of like the Russian nesting doll of influences and inspirations. Like I got to do this. I don't know if I made you an offer where we just talked about it, but I was like, I would love to get a chance to publish this. And after I published Fables of Earl King Wood with Junie Ba, it was a really big project to kind of, you know, again, I didn't necessarily seek out. I worked with him and he approached me and was like, hey, I saw you do Kickstarters. Would you do this with me? Because I think the idea of doing a Kickstarter, doing it all for yourself is appealing to a lot of artists and writers, but there is a lot of work involved.
Yes.
That isn't necessarily the kind of work come across as a writer or an artist, but as an editor, you do tend to do a lot of that kind of work. It transfers very well. You do a lot of planning, a lot of project management. I had been in the position to do, you know, stuff like running print quotes and getting shipping manifests and all that stuff. Like I had an idea. It's still like a lot to do it all yourself, but ultimately, you know, this is our fourth Kickstarter, Lake Yellowwood. I'm super excited to be working with a very good friend, but also to be putting out such a unique project. And our second year anniversary, we have some, you know, big stuff planned. But ultimately, my MO for Goats is we want to do the kind of comics we want to do. We want to figure out a way to make them happen. I like, and I have a pretty wide kind of taste in comics and styles and everything. Like, I want to do it. We'll find a way to make it happen. Our motto is comics against all odds. Nice. Make comics, the odds are never in your favor. And that's kind of it. We are completely creator-owned. We are vehemently anti-AI, so much so that is in our contract language. I tried to get in that if you use AI and I don't notice, but then I notice, I can name your firstborn child. But my legal reps.
That's known as a witch clause, I believe.
he said my legal rep said that it's technically doable but would be hard to be like, he was like, how many hours do you want me to build to try and figure out a language for this? It's like none, because I don't have a lot of money. That's the other thing. Ghost Flying Press is like 100% us funded. Mm-hmm. You know, we make the Kickstarter money, the you know, the publisher takes a cut, everything else goes to the creators, and that's it. We're, you know, small scrappy stuff, but I think the quality that we're putting out is something that, like, again, I've worked, you know, at Marvel, I've worked for a number of other, you know, publishers with big how-do, but I feel like the last 2 years was the happiest I've ever been making comics.
Oh, that's awesome.
That's awesome. And I'll just mention for anybody, I dropped the Kickstarter link in the chat over there, but right now on an $8,000 goal, you have $25,000, with 24 days to go, and it was funded in 95 minutes is what you said here.
Wow.
So that seems to be doing pretty well. Hopefully you get the comic book club bump that will put you over the top. But I guess we'll see what happens.
It's been very exciting. We started out with a long list of stretch goals, mm-hmm. and we've already unlocked like three or four very exciting ones.
so yeah, we're number five now. We're, yeah, I mean, this is fun. It's really heartening. Because the first couple of, a Kickstarter is always wild. Like, I've done a couple now, and I still, like, my nails are, down to the pump. And, because you're so focused on it, and then it's just numbers going up, which is very bad for, anyone who has ADHD, which, I guess all of us do a little bit. But we're hearing from a number of backers now who can, like, I've backed you since the start. I've backed you. Quality's great. And, like, that's all I want, because that's awesome. Both of us coming from direct market comics, where your success is measured in metric like 50,000 units sold or 10,000 units sold or whatever it is now. It used to be 50,000 units sold. Now it's kind of like Irving was a big success for us, and we had 800 backers. We're kind of like eyeing 1,000 backers. That would be an amazing hit sometimes, maybe with like Illwood, maybe with another book in the future. But it's about growing something slow, I think, in recent times, I think explosive growth in comics is something that has happened, where a publisher will appear, they'll have like huge, full broadside dark power, and then the second year rolls around and they kind of shot their wad. And the film and television success that we as an industry have kind of bolted our success train to won't really crystallize. Obviously, we have the pandemic and we had the strike, so there's a lot of stuff going on. I mean, that's the other thing.
We're no longer.
Oh, hello! Oh, that's what you guys look like. Oh, nice to see you.
There was more sunlight before.
Yeah.
No, it was getting very moody. It was nice. It was disturbing. Yeah. There was going to be somebody. There was going to be a slasher behind you. Who was going to decapitate you guys. But
it's one of the yellow words.
One other thing that I wanted to mention that I thought was very neat was you guys did a launch event at the Nighthawk Cinema near Prospect Park, which is so great. You got to put it on the marquee and everything. That's so fun. The only thing that bummed me out, since you guys are Brooklynites, and this is very niche-y, but I was a little bummed it wasn't still the Pavilion Theater, which is what it was before the Nighthawk, aka the worst movie theater of all time, which would have felt like a little dilapidated movie theater falling apart, kind of perfect for the graphic novel, but it's all right. You had the swanky Nighthawk. What was that experience like?
Were you mad at them because the theater they are is doing better? I mean, geez.
Did you ever go to the Pavilion, Pete?
Oh yeah, I got bed bugs there a couple of times.
It's so terrible. They had hot water in the water fountains. It was awful. Awful place.
The Pavilion Theater was a real dump before it was the Pavilion Theater, it was the Sanders Theater. Mm-hmm. And if you go to the Kickstarter page and you watch the video, we have a photo in there of the Sanders Theater marquee from approximately 1973, maybe. Oh, the movie's playing Enter the Dragon and Dracula AD 1972, which is very, very cool.
Enter the Dragon.
It was classic. Pretty, you 100% should have done this, but it was funny watching the Kickstarter video being like, it's the Nighthawk now. But before that, I was like, oh no, they're going to say the Pavilion. And you skipped backwards in time past the Pavilion to the theater before, and I was like, all right, good move, don't mention the Pavilion ever.
And it was so hot in that theater that people were like taking off, like just sitting there like in sweats in their underwear. So halfway through the movie I look around and everyone looks like they're in the War Boys, like they're just completely over the movie is so riveting. I was like, this is not good, but I'm enjoying the kind of the added realism here. But much better theater now.
Yes. You were asking what the experience was like. What it actually was is that, over the years, we've befriended a couple of the people who work over there. And we actually shot the Kickstarter video at the Nighthawk inside, like in one of the screening rooms and at the VHS wall that they have upstairs. Actually, I guess we didn't use any of that footage. But anyway, we were friends with them and they welcomed us in and we were able to shoot and do all that stuff. And then in order to make the package complete, we went ahead with like renting the marquee, which was a thing, which was not a thing they could give us for free. It was a thing we actually had to commit a little budget to and rent it. And then, it was incredible. It was up for 24 hours. It was like giddy, like a dream to see a title there. And then in order to, in order to maybe manage the confusion that it would bring up, we had a stack of, we gave them a bunch of the ash cans, the preview cans that we had been distributing recently. So if somebody walked by and they saw that marquee and they went inside mm-hmm. and they asked, what movie is that? I've never even heard of it. They'd be like, oh, it's a comic book. Here, you can take one of them.
Oh,
funny cool. enough, when I went to go drop off the comics, I said hi to one of the bartenders who I didn't know. I introduced myself. I said, I'm here about the marquee. He was like, oh, yeah, I really want to see that. What is it? What's that screening? What is it?
Yeah. The funniest outcome from this book would be...
No, but I mean, it was super fun to do. And again, as a young publisher, one of the things I think the comics does not do well is like let people know that we make amazing stuff all the time. Marketing is, I don't know, compare every other entertainment field where the budget for making the thing is on par with the budget for marketing to let people know, to like literally craft like a laser guided missile to penetrate, you know, your shield around people's heads. So like comics don't do that. They're like, oh, you'll be in the comic book shop every Wednesday, right? Maybe you'll see our cover. So knowing that I cannot allot a huge budget to thing, I'm like, well, I live literally across the street from this movie theater. I know people there. I'm planning something big. Like I want to just kind of get into the habit of not saying no to something that I really want to do just because it seems unfeasible or there's a little bit of money involved. For long term, again, as a publisher, I want to make wings. I want to do weird stuff. I want to make people pay attention because doing this is the best thing in the world. It's super fun and I love doing it. And bring a, you know, like polish to a Kickstarter video, which you'd be forgiven for not kind of making, hiring two filmmakers, a cameraman, renting space, bringing out props. Like, but if you think about it only in those terms, it's like, well, then yeah, just shoot it on your video phone and video and it'll be done. But like, again, Goat's Flank Press is all about like grabbing everything that we want, we've always wanted, and doing it ourselves.
It's also surprising, a lot of things are not really that expensive, but you would just never think to do them. Like we were talking about this book and what are the stretch goals going to be, et cetera. And we decided like, it would be so fun to do a soundtrack. It would be even funnier to do a movie soundtrack because, mm-hmm. And then Sebastian looked into it and it was like, no, it's doable. We can do it. So yeah, that's one of the stretch goals that we unlocked is a original motion picture soundtrack on cassette.
That's awesome.
Awesome.
Guys, this project is so cool. Congratulations on all the success. Congratulations in advance on the comic book club bump that I'm sure you're going to get. But also, I'm glad we could accidentally bring you guys together. That's a fun thing to find out many, many years later. So good luck with everything. Looking forward to reading the book and have a great night.
Same to you. Thank you. Thank you so much.
All right. Thanks, guys.
Take care, guys.
All right. Once again, the book is called Lake Yellowwood Slaughter. It's up on Kickstarter now for the next
great cover.
Oh, I took down the page, but let's say 24 days, whatever it is. Don't wait until the end. Get it in 20 days. Get it in 50. Pledge right now while you're listening. Pause the podcast unless you're watching live, in which case keep watching and then go to the link. And there you go. And folks, we're going to move to our next section, which is my favorite section because you all make it up. It is your audience questions. And for audience questions, all you got to do is drop a question in the comments, not on Facebook. That's still not going tonight. But YouTube, Twitch, I'll take a little glancy poo at Instagram as well. Pete, what you drinking?
Oh, I am drinking a Conezilla.
Ooh, in honor of Godzilla?
In honor of Tim Seeley Day.
Tim Seeley Day.
Yeah.
You love him so much.
Yeah. Well, you know, he's a fun gentleman who's helped us and done many interviews over the years.
He's great. He's great. That actually drinks reminded me, before I forget, I did want to mention one other thing that I always thought was very funny about the pavilion. And for anybody who didn't live in Brooklyn, again, this is like, this movie theater was the fifth pit of hell. And I don't say this lightly. It was absolutely the worst on so many levels. But the funniest thing to me is after all the bed bug infestations and the hot rooms and hot water, and like my wife and I went to see a 3D movie that they showed in regular 2D and then insisted, they're like, no, you were just watching it wrong, and wouldn't refund us afterwards. Right before they close, they opened up in the same places, like behind the snack bar with the popcorn, they opened up a smoothie bar. as if like that was going to fix everything. Like their band-aid on everything was they're like, and now we have smoothies. Like I would ever drink a smoothie that was full of bed bugs for the pavilion. But anyway, crazy, terrible place. Also, there's another feature here on StreamYard I wanted to try out. If you don't mind, Pete, it's going to be a little bit of a disaster, I think.
Oh, fun.
But apparently we can show the comments on the stage. Oh, it's not working. Why is it not working?
Well, it's because you queued it up and made it a big deal. Right. You know what I mean? If you just done it.
There's like a weird gray box here now. Nope, that's not doing it. Nope, that's you. You're gone. Now you're back. Now,
whoop.
There's still a gray box behind you. Yeah. You know what? This doesn't work. Never mind. Just kidding. All right. We got a question here from Stray Bullet. Eric Drucker brought up that artists today are having a tougher time surviving as artists compared to years ago. But we live in a time of social media where artists get discovered. Thoughts?
Yeah. I mean, it's an interesting thing. There are more ways to kind of jump up and say, notice me, check me out for sure. But yeah, it's things are expensive. I mean, I don't know what it would have been like being an artist during the Great Depression, but I figured that would be tough as well, you know? So yeah, I can understand a little bit of both sides to this little, you know?
Yes. I mean, I think what Brett is getting at here is something I believe very strongly in. Like, I think a lot of people are very derogatory about social media and influencers and people putting up stuff on TikTok or Instagram or whatever, but it has led to a real democratization of content. I was having a conversation with somebody the other day, I don't remember who it was, about like comedy in particular.
Maybe it was JT Sizzle.
No, I think it was somebody else. Actually, I think it was on one of our podcast interviews that I did at WonderCon, and I don't remember which one. But how comedy, it used to be like you could do it in New York, you could do it in Los Angeles, you could do it in Chicago, but only for a little while, and then you had to move to New York or Los Angeles. That's pretty much it. That is 100% not true anymore, and I think that's great that you could be in the smallest of small towns in the Midwest and become a comedy superstar at the same level as somebody who is working every night at stand-up clubs in New York. You know, there's different things that you're aiming for and different skills, I think, but that's fantastic. And so in that end, in terms of the discovery part, that's great. But yeah, as James Emmett brings up here, follow count doesn't equal money. That's the big thing. It's like, follow count doesn't equal money, but also getting discovered doesn't mean you get to continually do your art, which actually ties in very nicely with the message in Naked City, because what Eric Drucker says there, everybody should read the book, it's really good, is all of these artists, as they become more popular, start to lose a little bit of the purity of their art, which is just something that kind of naturally happens. So to get back to what Brett's saying, it's certainly hard on a more traditional track to get noticed. Like if you're just like, I'm slaving away in my New York apartment, creating art, taking it around to galleries, that's not exactly how it works anymore. But if you're putting it up on Instagram, how are you going to get noticed? Is it just purely for your art, or is it going to be trends? Is it going to be hashtags? Do you have to be a businessman or businesswoman? There's a lot of other factors there that come in the middle there that really complicate things intensely. And the last part in terms of the tougher is, I think we all know this, but not to get too wonky and too into it, but billionaires and gigantic companies swallow up the smaller companies, squeeze them out in a way that is even worse now, I think, than it was years ago. So it makes it harder and harder and harder to be in that middle area or that bottom area. So I don't know. Anyway, conversely, Corey Cherry says, what would your signature Oreo flavor be?
How is that? What was it? The s'mores one with the...
S'moreos?
Yeah, the new s'mores flavor.
Yeah. You're right, Pete? You need an Oreo? You seem like you're...
I would love an Oreo.
All right. You seem like it sucked all of your energy out to even think about Oreos, or you got lost in the cream there. I think this is riffing off of Selena Gomez announced her own Oreo today, which sounds delicious. It's a cinnamon chocolate cookie with cinnamon chocolate cream. And then the other one is like cinnamon crystal, like a horchata cream almost type thing. So
you don't think it's too much cinnamon?
No.
You don't think she over cinnamon?
Never. Selena Gomez? Absolutely not.
Wow.
Signature Oreo flavor, probably like, I'm going to say like a golden cookie with pepperoni and a mozzarella cheese cream would be pretty good.
Wow. I like a duplex. I like the, you know, the vanilla and the chocolate. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Oh, you'd be you'd be an Oreo. Interesting. Schreckler says, what are some comics that really captured Brooklyn for you?
Brooklyn. That was a great comic that, came out there. You know, do you remember that comic, Brooklyn?
No, I don't remember that comic. Who did that comic?
Or... Are you sure? It's a, what's his face? He does the, oh my God, the comic with Harley Quinn and his wife.
Jimmy Palmiotti?
Yeah.
Oh, I do remember that.
Yes, thank you.
That book did capture Brooklyn, you're correct.
We joked about how Brooklyn it was when it came out.
Any book Frank Thierry does.
Yeah, that's for sure. That's a good call.
I don't know. Edward Doherty says, has Batman watched a single movie or read a single book for fun since his parents died?
Nope.
No.
Yeah.
His parents died.
Yeah, there's no time for that.
Yeah. He tries, but it always reminds him of his parents.
Yeah, he can't watch a movie. I mean,
yeah. I'm just going to read this Dr. Seuss book. Hop on Pop! Oh, no. Anyway. Frederica Rosa says, thoughts on the trailers of Ironheart and Superman that came out that last week. Pete, did you get to see those, or are you too busy with Ska Mania?
I was a little too busy. I keep trying to watch this new Superman trailer, and I turned it off. It looks like a TV show. I don't know.
Because it's so brightly colored?
Yeah, it's just weird. It throws me off.
Well, you're a Snyderhead. You're a real Snyderverse guy, right? Like,
man,
you like the desaturated colors.
I want it dark, man.
Yeah.
I need it. Mm. Dark Man. Shouts out to Dark Man. That was a great movie.
There was somebody, I'm forgetting the exact context, but there was some Snyder fan that posted like a picture of Henry Cavill waving, and then it was a picture of David Corenswet waving, and they were like, see, Snyder set up everything. I was like, that is two guys in a Superman suit waving high. What are you talking about? Get over it, man.
I hope Ironheart's good.
Yeah. Good trailer.
Yeah.
I don't know. And the Superman trailer was the one that kind of sold me on it, honestly. Like, the argument between Lois and Superman at the beginning, I thought was fantastic. That was a great Lois Lane scene. That was the first one that made me feel something so far. Mm-hmm. So I'm stoked.
At the first Super Bowl commercial for Superman got me excited for it. And then this latest trailer turned me off. Wow, so I don't know.
This is the first time I'm noticing this, but you and I have different opinions, Pete.
Oh, man.
Bandino740 says, I was watching Comic Tropes the other night, and he mentioned watching Casually Comics. Do you guys have time to watch any other comic book YouTubers? Not usually.
No, I don't.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, we talk so much comics.
I know.
Yeah.
I try. Like, I try to keep up with what everybody's doing, and there's certainly podcasts that I know are good. I think we talked about it here on the podcast. But I was listening to the Sketched podcast, the interview with Jonathan Hickby the other day, which I thought was great. Comic Book Couples Counseling is doing a great job as
Word
well.
Word Balloon's my jam.
Yeah. And there was, oh my God, I'm blanking on the name of it. I'm going to look it up in a second because I feel bad. But there was a great concept for a podcast where it was a news report from the DC Universe, where it was like, we're bringing you the stories from the DC Universe. So they do it once a week. It's about the books that came out, but as if they were real and live in the DC Universe. That's the perspective. It's like an 8 to 10 minute podcast. And I was like, that's a really fun, idea.
That's a great idea.
I'll look up the title of it while you answer the next question. Pete, what is Aurora's Oreo flavor? Don't answer that question. All right, here we go. Which comic best captures the feeling of Staten Island? These questions, you guys.
Oh, man. Let's see. Staten Island. Best comic. I'm trying to think of something that would be more depressing than like concrete. You know what I mean? I want that tone of concrete, you know? Maybe some like Wu-Tang origin story comic or something like that. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Maybe. I can't think of one. I'm sorry.
Yeah. Nat Townsend, me sharing a brain. He said Bergie's Wu-Tang comic.
There you go. There you go. Most anticipated cover coming this summer.
Ooh, man. I'm sure there's a lot of sick covers coming out this summer. I can't wait. I love a good cover. Nothing better than a good cover, man.
We got a couple of recommendations here. James Evans says, I like Casually Comics. Nice. Love Comic Book Yeti. Yeah, there you go. Those were two other suggestions as well. All right, there we go. I'll have to look for that podcast. I apologize to the people who do that DC Universe podcast because I couldn't find it immediately. But maybe I could do it while we're doing our next section.
Hey, what's the next thing? Oh, hey.
I'm going to turn it over to Pete LePage.
All right. This is the part we give back to you, the lovely audience. It's an opportunity to win $25 free dollars to Midtown Comics Online, because if you had $25, you'd probably want to go to a comic book shop and see, you know, hey, let's see what comics they got. You know what I mean? Maybe mm-hmm. you got that one you've been looking for, that one you've been chasing your whole life. You know what I mean? So we just need a first-hand up guy, or, oh, hey, we got a couple. Here we go. Spaceman Frank looks like he's first.
Ooh, there we go. Congrats, Spaceman
Shout-outs to Goody Squeegee, though. So close.
Shouts.
Oh, Nat Townsend's got you. DC Action News is what it's called.
DC Action News. Thank you, Nat. There we go.
Nat used our Discord to find it.
That's got to patreon.com/comicbookclub. Join the Discord.
Man. Man, that's a great resource for things, turns out.
All right.
Pete. All right, here we go. Today's trivia is about Tim Seeley and a small nod to the legend, Bruce Glover. R.I.P. Mr. Wint, the Bond villain. All right, please listen to all three options before making your selection. Here we go. Question number one. Tim Seeley has got skills. We all know that. He's a great writer and a great blank. Is it A, artist, B, candle zombie, or C, Jerry Rector?
He is a great Jerry Rector. This is a tough one. Oh, gosh. That's good. Do you think he'd like to hear that, that Tim Seeley is a great Jerry Rector? Do you want to tell him that in person the next time you see him?
No, I don't. I don't.
Okay. We are still... Oh, Spaceman Frank says A it is.
A it is. It is A. Well there done. Here we go. Question number two. What was Tim Seeley's first comic he worked on? Was it A, Life of a Candle Zombie, B, G.I. Joe, or is it C, James C?
Are you going to explain the candle zombie thing at the end? Or
I don't know.
Want to spoil it. I don't want to spoil it.
Yeah, well, I could.
Oh, do you have it right there?
I could use that to explain it. There he is. Look at that candle zombie.
Yes. I will explain it then for anybody who's listening on the podcast, is you were a candle zombie in Hackslash.
That's
or
right.
More specifically, there's a character named Pete LaPage.
LaPage, that's LaPage. Right.
But it was you. We established it was still you.
Yeah, he didn't want to get sued by my people, which I think is smart.
Right.
But he's correct.
The LaPage Tape Company.
That's right. Which is huge in Canada, man.
Huge.
I'm telling you. He's correct. G.I. Joe is, I wanted to check with them on these, but I didn't get here in enough time to check with them on these. But that's what it says on Wikipedia. So, all right, here we go. Last one. Tim Seeley lives in Chicago, but was born in blank. Is it
very touchy feeling?
A, Wisconsin. B, do you like dairy better, or would you say more than you like berries? Or is it C, Debbie Dairy Berry?
Switching up there with one of those deep jokes right at the end, Pete. Last question.
Man.
No more candle zombie stuff, I guess. For a bonus, you're going to do what was his exact address that he was born at, right?
Because yeah.
Okay. It's... A, but I do like berries.
Hey, all right. Well done. Yes,
congratulations.
And it's funny because it just says Wisconsin. It doesn't get any more specific on where he was born.
Okay, but you're going to find out. You're going to do the time traveling Hitler thing, but a reverse where you travel back in time to give a baby a little kiss on the forehead.
Yeah, just to encourage him a little bit. So you're going to be all right, Tim Seeley. You just hang in there. You just hang in there, Tim Seeley. You're gonna change two or three people's worlds.
Oh, boy.
No, he's probably changed a lot more than that.
Spaceman Frank, congratulations. You're going to win a gift card to Midtown Comics. Shoot us an email. We'll get that off to you. Pete, what is the secret movie you were referencing?
Of course, we're talking about the 2001 cult classic Ghost World.
Oh, okay. Nope, that's not that type of ghost.
Nope, it's not that type of ghost.
And as we all know, tomorrow is New Comic Book Day. There are new comics coming out. Pete, what are you looking forward to?
I tell you what, I'm really looking forward to Wonder Woman number 21. Oh, just amazing art. Very touching, woven. A lot goes down. It's people are going to love it, I think, and I hope. And then The Thing number one, which, I don't know if you've heard, but it's holy fleecing shit. It's a great story.
Yes. Both of those are coming out. There's a bunch of stuff I'm really looking forward to that is coming out. Exceptional X-Men is coming out. I always love that book. I think I'm the main one on the podcast, but I guess
sure are, buddy.
We'll find out. I really like that, though. I like the domestic CW-style drama, but through the X-Men world. Also, new issue of Ultimates is coming out. Ultimates number 12, so that's exciting. But to give a shout out to something that's not Marvel, let me find really quick. Oh, Superman Unlimited is coming out. Very curious to see that. That's Dan Slott's big first title. So that should be exciting to see. And folks, that is it for this week's show. A bunch of people we need to thank today. Yeah. We want to thank Tim Seeley for coming on.
Come on.
To talk about Godzilla. Tim Seeley, reminder, you can pre-order that book for your comic book store until June 9th or starting June 9th. Either way, just go to your comic book store and pre-order it. But it's coming out on July 23rd. Eric Drucker for talking about Dark Horse's Naked City, a graphic novel. You can check that out now. And Sebastian Gerner and Alejandro Arbona for talking about Lake Yellowwood Slaughter, which is on Kickstarter now. So check that out. Next week on the show, Punko is going to be here from Webtoons Stagtown, and Joshua Rubin will be talking about Time Sensitive, Comic Book Club News, our daily news podcast, Monday through Friday, patreon.com/comicbookclub, support this show and all the shows we do. Don't forget to subscribe on Apple, Android, Spotify, or the app of your choice, comicbookclublive.com for this podcast and many more. Until next time, we'll see you at the Comic Book Club.
Yeah, take care of yourself out there.
They sit on crappy couches and they let the secrets leak, and occasionally they let that special guest speak. So grab your grin
Hey, baseball fans, it's time to swing big on your bets this season. Step up to the plate with an odds boost token from BetMGM, an official sports betting partner of Major League Baseball. No opt-in is required. Just log into your BetMGM account to receive your odds boost token. Then, place a bet on any MLB game and activate your token. If your boosted bet hits, you'll score a bigger payout, no matter the showdown. BetMGM is your betting home for baseball. Major League Baseball trademarks used with permission. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. See BetMGM.com for terms. 21 plus only. This U.S. promotion offer not available in Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. For New York, call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369. For Arizona, call 1-800-NEXT-STEP. For Massachusetts, 1-800-327-5050. For Iowa, 1-800-BETS-OFF. For Puerto Rico, 1-800-981-0023. Subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards vary and expire in 1 to 7 days. In partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy.
just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.